Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, Jay Paterno talks about Penn State and COVID and his new book. But up front, what is quantum computing and how will it change our lives? Google has officially announced that it's achieved quantum supremacy in a new article published in the scientific journal Nature. Google says that its 54-qubit Sycamore processor was able to perform a calculation in 200 seconds that would have taken the world's most powerful supercomputer 10,000 years. IBM and others have disputed this claim, but the fact remains that quantum computing will change how we do business, medical research, and even predicting climate change. Joining us to explain quantum computing is Dr. Terrell France, Associate Professor at Harrisburg University of Science and Technology. Dr. France, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott.
All right, so let's start with the technology itself. What is quantum technology?
Well, quantum technology is taking us humans, taking advantage of the subatomic physics that go on in the world around us all the time. And we're trying to embrace the special characteristics of that physics for our purposes, for computation, for clocking, you know, atomic clocks, for MRI machines, etc.
Now, when you say subatomic, explain that a little bit.
Well, the atom is what I mean. So smaller than the atom size dynamics and physics. And, you know, an atom, I'm rather new to the physics part of it personally. I come from the computational side. But an atom has things like electrons and protons, or electrons floating around it, and things like light protons. These are very, very small parts of nature that have behaviors that are quite different than what we see in everyday physics. When you throw a baseball, you can predict where it will go based on the speed and the size and the wind velocity and all that. Whereas in the quantum realm, in the smaller than atom level of physics, the world looks quite different down there.
All right, so I asked about quantum technology. What about quantum mechanics?
Well, quantum mechanics is the study of what these atoms and protons and electrons and neutrons, how they all behave as objects. And that's a field that I'm not an expert in. I'm just learning how to utilize it. But that's essentially, you know, how does an aroma, when someone lights a cigarette in a room, how does that aroma flow around in the airspace and in the room there, for example? So that's part of quantum mechanics and quantum physics.
Okay, so I'm trying to ask these questions kind of in a chronological order. So here's the big question. Okay. What is quantum computing?
So quantum computing is where we take all these, what we consider strange behaviors, strange physics or strange mechanics, and start to look at those that strangeness and ask the question, hey, can we do something useful with this in the computing realm? And so are there things that we can do, like factor numbers? What are the two numbers when multiplied together give you 21, 3 and 7? Well, that's actually a very hard thing for a classical computer to do. So we're looking at, and a quantum computer should be able to do that fairly easily. So what we're trying to do is take those strange mechanics, harness them, and be able to use them as a computing device.
When you say that, now you use an example of adding 3 and 7, that is actually hard for the computers that we have today. Really? I mean, that kind of, we all kind of take it for granted. I mean, we've had calculators around for decades now. So why is that difficult for the computing that we have today?
Well, let me correct that. It's it's finding the two factors of 21 I'm using as an example. So what two numbers when multiplied together give you 21? Well, most of us older folk, me in particular, when I was in grade
I'm there
school,
with you.
We memorized the multiplication tables. Remember the 12 by 12 tables? So
we can
answer that question very quickly. A classical computer cannot do that so eloquently as we can as humans. We don't have classical computer does not have 21 or 3 times 7 memorized. So it has to do some mathematical tricks and maneuvers to figure out what those two numbers are. And in a quantum computer, we have, using this quantum mechanics and the physics underneath, we can actually figure that out rather quickly. And the real task is not what are the two factors to 21. Any classical computer can do that rather quickly just by brute force guessing. We're talking about factoring numbers like a 1 with 300 zeros behind it, for example. Incredibly, incredibly large numbers and that we can factor using a quantum computer. In theory, anyway, in theory at the moment.
You just mentioned 1 and zeros. Now, I don't want to get too deep in the weeds here, but explain how the computers we use today use, and any kind of digital device that we use today, uses one and zeros.
That's a good question. We do need to start there. So, and we have entire semester-long courses at the university on this. So, but I'll try to put it into a paragraph. You know, your classical computer, the word I use for your laptops or your phone or your desktop, or even a supercomputer in a large laboratory, are all based on digital electronics. And what that means is it's really billions, literally billions of these little tiny switches in your device that are either on or off. And what we as humans do say, we say that, okay, well, if the switch is off, we're going to consider that a zero. And if the switch is turned on, much like a light switch, then we'll consider that a one. Now, what that is, so what we do then is we have a numbering system that is called the binary numbering system, and which is a numbering system that just has zero and one, and with just has the two digits, 0 and 1, unlike our decimal numbering system, which has 0 through 9. The decimal system has 0 to 1. So we can do math, we can put words on a screen, we can do an endless number of things with just the notion of 0 and 1. I could go on further, but I'm waving my hands around, Scott, so I don't know if those can see that.
My next question is, from what I understand, quantum computers will be able to do both zeros and ones at the same time. Is that correct?
It's sort of correct, and it's nuanced when you get really into it. But let me give the best example, the best explanation I can. So on your laptop or your cell phone, to represent the number 1.3, let's say $1.30, to represent that number takes 64 of those bits that we just talked about, 64 of those switches. And in a quantum computer, that number, 1.30, could be represented in just one, what we call qubit, which is similar to a bit, but that qubit can have values that are nearly infinite. So instead of just representing 0 or 1, a quantum qubit can represent a number no matter how large or how complex or how small, just a single qubit could do that. And that brings to the table all kinds of magical things we can do with computation. So that's the layman's explanation of why a quantum computer is different. In one bit, we could have a number as large or as small as you want versus the number 1.3 taking 64 bits in a classical computer, for example.
Mm. We're going to talk about some of the things that quantum computers can do or will be able to do in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest today is Dr. Terrell France at Harrisburg University of Science and Technology. We're talking about quantum computing. And I hope we didn't get too far into the weeds, Dr. France, explaining how it works. But now let's talk about some of the uses for quantum computing. What feats might quantum computers be able to perform?
Well, I think this is a little bit less hand-wavy, Scott, so that this is a much easier question to answer or respond to. So this is where the excitement comes in. You know, what can these devices do and that we can't do today? And that's really the key. First of all, we believe that quantum computers will be able to accomplish computational tasks that are just physically impossible with our classical computers. So as you mentioned, Google conducted a computational experiment recently that would take a classical computer, you know, a projected 10,000 years to do. So what are these applications? Well, for one, we in biology and in medicine, we are quite limited to the amount of simulation we can conduct for weather, for example. The classical computers cannot represent the number of variables necessary to predict the weather or to predict the effectiveness of a drug or a medication. There's just so many variables that need to be taken into account when you simulate the human body or weather we just don't have that computing capacity, even in the largest computers in the world working together. We can't simulate those phenomena. Now with a quantum computer, we believe we will be able to simulate those really, really complex phenomena. And first of all, let me just say that I keep saying we believe because quantum computers are not out of the laboratory yet, per se. That might be fuel for another question. but right now, if you think of it this way, all right, nature is constantly computing things. The direction of the wind, where some smoke goes around in a room, those are actually computations that nature undertakes every day. And so if we were to simulate nature, if we were to simulate biology, we basically have come to the conclusion that we'll need to utilize the way nature computes, and that is nature computes at the subatomic level. So we're not inventing anything new here, actually, which is quite interesting. But we are really just using nature's computer to simulate nature, and you can't go wrong with that. So that's one example. The one application that has governments and companies and us individuals we should be concerned is that I mentioned the factorization math problem earlier, and that's a big deal because all of our security, all of our digital security, the way the internet works, the way we can send emails encrypted, the way we can encrypt data files, etc., talk on the phone without others listening. That is all based on this big factorization math problem I mentioned before. And so that is a application of these quantum computers that will essentially break our encryption when it comes to digital security. And that's got people concerned, as well as, the simulation, which is something entirely new that we can't do today. So it has some defensive aspects to it, as well as offensive aspects to it, if you think of it that way.
Well, and I mean, we can talk a little bit more about that, but from what I understand, the U.S. is in a bit of an arms race with China when it comes to quantum computing, correct?
That's the way I see it. And Scott, again, you're probably too young to remember this, but in the 1960s, the United States was in a race to the moon against the USSR. And if you ask your parents or grandparents about that, you'll know that it really was not about putting a human on the moon and returning them safely to Earth. It was really a one-upsmanship, United States versus USSR. And that's what's happening. It's just beginning to come to the fore, except in this case, it's the United States versus China in the one-upsmanship in the quantum computing area. So it is a space race of sorts.
But that one-upsmanship that you're talking about could have real-world consequences. If you're talking about weaponry, if you're talking about security, you're talking about AE, it would seem, even though, you know, the case could be made that about the militarization of space in the 1960s and 70s, that there could be some real danger involved with this.
Absolutely. The U.S. government is certainly starting to invest and pay attention into the quantum computing and all of the quantum modalities of that. So, for example, you know, atomic clocks, they need to be more precise for submarines to navigate under the water, because I don't know if many of the listeners realize it, but GPS does not work underwater. So, yeah, the military in both countries and other countries as well, the UK, India, Europe, et cetera, all are starting to delve heavily into all this quantum science stuff going on for military purposes. Absolutely.
You gave the example of predicting weather, and I assume that goes, weather is different than climate, that there could be some real advances made in climate change, predicting what will happen climate change with quantum computing. But some other advances, right now we're in the middle of a pandemic, and there are many different companies, scientists, researchers out there trying to find a vaccine, trying to find a way to treat COVID-19. Under a real-world scenario, I'm not going to ask specifically about COVID, but looking for vaccines, looking for treatments for different medical conditions, diseases, Alzheimer's, for example, what could a quantum computer do in that area?
Well, a quantum computer with its simulation capability, its ability to simulate phenomena that are just too complex for our supercomputers to deal with today, that's what the quantum computer will bring to the table. And so what that means is we could simulate a drug in a body, for example, and simulate what would happen, with, let's say you had an option of 10 different types of drugs to take. You could run a quantum computer simulation and determine which are the two best prospects out of that. Currently, as I understand it, when an idea for a new drug becomes of interest, we actually need to conduct experiments in the laboratory with human cells and all of that. And so those experiments can take months. to play out in real time. You know, what how does a cell react with this particular medication or something like that? I'm not a chemist, but that will take weeks to play out. The COVID trials, for example, take months. And what a quantum computer can do with its simulation capability can cut the number of options, the number of experiments that need to be played out, down to a manageable few instead of literally millions of options. And that I think is in essence, we will speed up the drug invention process, or what have you. I'm not a chemist.
with what you're talking about here, as you said, it's still in the laboratory. Who is pushing quantum computing? I mean, I would imagine the scientific community, but what about the federal government? I mean, is there government funding? There has to be some money that is going into this research if it's still in a laboratory.
Oh, yes. Yes. Basically, right now, it's estimated around $22 billion is being invested in the year 2020 by governments around the world. And now $22 billion is a lot of money for maybe for me and maybe you, but it's still a small number globally, but it is rapidly increasing. So this past year, the U.S. government put a $1 billion towards quantum programs directly, and there are other monies trickling in from governments under different programs and such. We believe, because of this space race that we talked about, we believe that this is just the beginning of investments by countries around the world. There's also of interest or of importance in the past 3 or 4 years, private capital, the venture capitalists are starting to put money into the industry, which is a sign that more and more people are willing to put more and more money at risk for this technology.
You know, and I want to talk about something that is, and this kind of gets back to one of our basic questions, but classical computers and supercomputers are relatively small today. I mean, we think about how things have changed over the last 50 years. The phone that we hold in our phone is as powerful as the computers of 30 years ago. The quantum computer in the Google blog that you talked about, it's pretty large and it's kind of complicated. How likely is it that these could be made in the future on a mass scale?
Well, let me put it this way. In 1940, the ENIAC computer, which many listeners may have seen the photos of, is a room-sized computer with 4 or 5 people operating that computer, and it was run on vacuum tubes, and it was much less powerful than your average smartphone today. And that was 1940. So we are in the 1940s when it comes to quantum computers. The size, first of all, it hasn't been said, but it's really important to get this out to everyday listeners, is that, a quantum computer we do not believe a quantum computer will replace your classical computer. It's a quantum computer is not something you're going to have on your phone. Now, I say that kind of tongue-in-cheek, because back in 1940, IBM, Thomas Watson, the president of IBM, said, I can't imagine there's more than a market of more than 5 computers in the whole world. So we humans are notoriously bad at predicting the future. Very few people expect that a quantum computer will replace the classical computer that we have today. It's more of an auxiliary device, a device that kind of sits on the side and is used for very specific and very technically challenging problems. Unlike our classical computer or your phone, which is very mundane, it doesn't really do a lot of heavy duty calculation. So a quantum computer will not replace your classical computer, at least in our lifetimes.
But I have to say that I'm feeling a little bit leery, Dr. France, when you describe the capabilities that the quantum computer can do, that it has to infiltrate my laptop or my phone coming down the road. I mean, will we be able to come up with security for our classical computers that will keep us safe and secure?
Oh, yeah. Okay. So, yeah, don't panic about that, Scott.
Okay. All right. Because I feel like I'm in the dinosaur age now.
No, please. This is new stuff, and this is rocket science. So I doubt many listeners really have a clue or a handle on this. Albert Einstein even had a problem with this quantum physics, so we're all confused and all in good company. So the quantum computer will be more like an auxiliary device out in the cloud that you just ship off really, really difficult problems. Getting back to the security question, NIST, which is the National Institutes of Standards and Technology here in the United States, is leading really a global effort on defining what we call post-quantum cryptography, and that is the cryptographic processes that will not be able to be broken by a quantum computer. So the security that we have in the internet today, they have new algorithms, new techniques being developed right now and being studied to replace that security that we have. They're expected to make announcements in the year 2023 as to which of the methodologies in a competition that's going on, which methodologies look to be the best. But they're called post-quantum cryptography techniques, and they'll get us over the hump when it comes to the security issue. However, there is an issue that the data being stored today, the data that's being transferred today on the internet, et cetera, is more than likely being caught by some large companies and or governments. And so that encrypted data is not protected by future encryption techniques. So governments in particular are particularly concerned about confidential things that are being stored by other governments. And when a quantum computer comes out, all those secrets could easily be public. So that's the concern right now is in the future, I think we'll be okay, but the current data is at risk.
So, Dr. France, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. One final question. How close are we to quantum computing being a reality?
Well, you know, a lot of that is the answer to the response to that is buried in what do you mean by reality? What do you mean by a quantum computer, et cetera? So we do have different levels of reality. And IBM, for example, and a handful of others do have quantum computers that the public can actually use. So you could say they are real. We have access to 5-qubit quantum computers that are 5 qubits in size, which is not really useful other than for learning. IBM just published a roadmap recently on their roadmap of how to get to 1,000 or more qubits in the next 3 years or so. So, we've got some time here, but you know, with big technologies like this, Scott, the world and universities, like Harrisburg University, for example, need to start to develop programs and start to train the workforce so that when these computers do become more common and are fully out of the lab, we have people that understand how these things operate and how to use them. So, you know, the computers are here now, but only with 5 qubits, really. There are some companies, like a company called D-Wave, a Canadian company, that does have a 5,000-qubit computer that is in production, but that has a much narrower range in application. So you asked a simple question, Scott, and when it comes to quantum computing, you're never, ever going to get a simple answer.
I think I learned that today. Dr. Terrell France, yeah. Associate Professor at Harrisburg University of Science and Technology. Dr. France, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Scott. Good to be here. Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Jay Paterno is a member of the Penn State Board of Trustees, a former assistant football coach at Penn State, and, of course, the son of legendary Penn State head coach Joe Paterno. In his just-published novel, Paterno writes about a fictional football coach under great pressure to win. That's the simple description. There's a whole lot more going on in his program and the world of college football. Jay Paterno is the author of Hot Seat, A Year Inside College Football's Pressure Cooker. Just Jay Paterno, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
All right, before we start talking about the book, I want to talk a little bit about what's going on at the campus at Penn State. As you as a board of a trustee member, let's talk about Penn State and COVID-19. Since students have returned to campus, the number of positive cases has increased, sometimes by a lot. Is there any one reason, or is it just because there's more people in State College and University Park that we've seen such an increase?
Well, I think realistically, you're bringing students back and you're putting them in Manhattan-style density housing, not just on campus, but off campus as well, and they're going to socialize. I mean, I think the administration put together about as good a game plan as you could put together, but ultimately the game plan has to be executed by 18 to 22-year-olds, so it's a little bit like football that in that regard. And I think for the most part, you know, I've guest lectured on twice on campus this fall, and the students have been spacing. They've had masks. I've been on campus a bunch just because I ride my bike from my house around campus occasionally. And they're doing it for the most part, and the cases, the latest case numbers seem to be falling. But again, as we've learned from COVID, you can't take anything for granted, and just because cases start to go down 1 week doesn't mean they'll stay that way. So I think, you know, this administration is as vigilant as they possibly can, and they've been very aggressive in the testing and even testing the wastewater that comes off campus to see if there are outbreaks that we don't know about. So, you know, it's just one of those things I think that it's a new time and place that we're in right now, and there are going to be some problems.
What is the role of the Board of Trustees in trying to slow the spread of the virus?
Well, thankfully, I'm not up to my eyeballs in the wastewater part of it, because that's not, I mean, not to make light of it, but I mean, we have been much more engaged as a board since March than we would normally be. Normally we have five meetings a year, but we had weekly calls for a long time. Sometimes they're weekly, sometimes every other week, depending on what's going on. And we've covered a number of issues, and we've been informed along the way, and they've asked for input on a number of things, you know, just to let us know. And so we've been involved, but, you know, when it comes down to it, we got to let the experts on campus do what they're doing. And I think they've done a really good job so far.
Has there been any thought yet, and maybe if not, do we reach a point where classes will go all virtual again?
Well, the number of classes that have a in-person component is about 47-48%. And again, that's an in-person component, which means that it's some virtual, you know, a lot of them are virtual or in-person along with the remote component. There's not a whole lot that are all in-person. But again, the number of classes being 48%, a lot of those are the smaller classes. If you look at the total number of seats that are in person all the time, it's a lot smaller than that. But I think ideally we'd like to keep students going to the classroom if we can. I think that's and we've been fortunate that we've been able to handle that so far very successfully. And also, any student that wishes to not come in person. They can take everything remotely, so professors have to make that available to them remotely. So that option is available for everybody.
And I'm going to move on to the book in here in just a moment. I drove through State College on Saturday, and I saw probably at least three different places where there were students, I don't know if I'd say parties, but at least 10 students or young people that were gathered shoulder to shoulder and appeared to be socializing. Who monitors that? I mean, is there any way to monitor that?
Well, I mean, too, but again, you run into, how much manpower or, enforcement power do you have? A lot of those are office, and they involve the borough has a number. The borough State College enacted a number of policies that they're enforcing, so they're in coordination with the university and with the borough. And again, one of the things that's tough about it is students are by nature, and I don't mean this in any derogatory way, but they're canine like, and that they want to travel in packs, and they want to socialize, and they want to be around each other. And we want them to act like felines and sit on the couch and tell everybody to stay the heck away from them. And it's hard to get them to change that behavior because that's what, that's what they want to do. So I think they've made strides. But again, those parties, there are parties that pop up here and there, and there have been fines. And, one fraternity was suspended for 4 years because they had a fairly large gathering. Now, that'll all get challenged when we start playing football in a couple weeks because students are obviously going to get together and watch the game. So that's one of the things that will be a challenge for us.
That analogy, I have to say, I've never heard that analogy before, but that leads in, that descriptive analogy leads into the literary part of our show. The book is Hot Seat, A Year Inside College Football's Pressure Cooker. What made you want to write a fictional book about a college football program?
Probably my own personal safety, and by that I mean, after 22 years of college football coaching, college football, or 21 years, whatever it was, I can't remember now, I think it's 22. Friends of mine would ask about what it's like, and I'd tell them stories. I wouldn't tell them who they involved, but I would say, oh, this happened in recruiting, or this happened in a meeting, or this happened whatever, and they'd say, you ought to start to put these together in a book. And I'd always made notes about stories like that, about with the idea that maybe I would write a book about it someday. And when I decided to do it, I said, I can't really put people's names in this. I got to protect the innocent, the not so innocent, and the flat out guilty. So I decided to make it into a novel, which is essentially fictional. But the reality is that it's very much real. I mean, the stories in here are very, very real. The pressures are very, very real. A lot of them are stories I lived or was part of in coaching. A lot of them are stories that guys I knew in coaching told me about and relayed, or recruits that we were involved with and things. So for anyone who really wants to see what it's like inside a college football program, this is the book to read.
Ed Hart is the main character. He's the fictional coach at Ohio State. Why Ohio State?
Well, I thought if I just wrote about Penn State, I wrote the book about my dad called Paternal Legacy, and I wanted to branch away from just writing about Penn State, number one. Number two, I wanted to challenge myself to see if I could write a novel, a fictional novel that is not set here, and do research. And, I've been out to Ohio State a number of times and was out there for some practices when Urban Meyer was still coaching after I was out of coaching. So, and having recruited in Ohio for 17 years, I had really a lot of familiarity with the high schools and the geography of the state and cities and towns and everything, because when you recruit, you're in every little hamlet and city that you have to get into. So there was familiarity there, and I wanted to just assign it somewhere else. And then all the stories that I assign to schools are done randomly. I don't want anybody to think that if something's about the University of North Carolina or about Penn State or Michigan or another school, that story actually happened there. I just I wanted to use real school names so that it would be familiar to people reading it. I don't want to create a school like Ohio Tech and, people say, what's Ohio Tech? Who do they play? I don't want to have to make all that stuff up because I don't want to keep it straight in my mind either.
The story starts after a bowl game loss with the president of the university talking with Coach Hart. Now, everyone on the team sees this. They're on the bus, and they see this meeting or the two of them talking, and they think that Coach Hart's job is in jeopardy. That sends a message to the coach, but it also sends a message to everyone else. And I don't want to give away too much here because you want people to read the book. But in what way, what message did that send, and how did people react when they see the president of the university talking with the coach?
Well, it sends a big, strong message, especially to assistant coaches whose fates are tied with the head coach, and players who, you know, if the coach gets fired, a new coach comes in, and then it's, I got to deal with a new coach. I got to start back at square one. I got to understand what the demands of the program are. I think one of the things that it does is it puts pressure on him, and then that pressure, you know, kind of rolls that, not rolls, it's applied downward as well, in that if the head coach is under fire and the recruiting's not going the right way, the recruiting coordinator is going to hear from the coach, and he knows, you know, it just creates this ratcheted level of pressure on top of everything else the coach has got to deal with. When you're coaching, it's now in this day and age, and it's been this way for about 10, 12 years in the social media age, maybe longer, it's 24/7 because your player can tweet something stupid, or somebody can see your player doing something, or video them doing something not supposed to, put on social media, or, you know, it's just constant. And when you're the head football coach, those pressures are bad enough, let alone with everybody knowing your job's on the line.
In fact, one of the first scenes, you talk about an assistant coach when he sees this meeting between the university president and the coach, starts sending an email to, I believe it was his agent. I mean, those things have actually occurred?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, guys are always, you know, again, when they know the head coach is in trouble, assistant coaches all start to think about, where's my exit strategy and where am I going to land? And that's very, very real. And the thing about college football coaches, assistant coaches, they're not unionized. So there's really no protections in terms of year to year when the contract's up. They don't renew you, you're done. And if the head coach gets fired, you get fired too, by and large. So that's very, very common. I mean, a lot more common than you think. I mean, they talk about loyalty among thieves, and not that coaches are thieves, but I mean, they're independent contractors in many cases, in many ways. So they're constantly looking for the next move. And I think the other thing about the book that I think was really good to write, and I hope people that read it get a feel for, is not just the assistant coaches, but the pressures and the relationship between the head coach and his wife, which it's his second wife, because the first wife couldn't handle it. I think I tried to illustrate that very, very much, really put that on the forefront as well, because I think those pressures go home too, and the family members feel it.
Yeah, the fans don't often think about that, but these are real people that feel the pressures, and their families, their wives, their kids, the schools they're going to, where they're moving, all these things are things that a lot of fans probably don't think about. In the book, there are coaches getting jobs for recruits' parents, alums wanting the coach fired, trying to influence the program, players drinking, one accused of rape. Ed Hart tries to survive all that. All those stories taken from things you've experienced or heard?
Oh, absolutely. Very much so, here and elsewhere. We've had situations where guys were accused of things they did not do. We had a very public one with Rashard Casey back in 2000, where he was wrongly accused of getting into a fight with an off-duty cop. And that grand jury went on for months and months and months, and we had to stand by him because we knew the facts of the case. Those things, the pressure on those things, because those stories become public, those accusations become public, and anytime a story attracts media attention, it also attracts other people that want to make political statements or stands on the backs of those people that are involved most directly in that story. So, yeah, a lot of those, like I said, these things are real. You know what I say in the show Law and Order, ripped from the headlines or whatever it is?
Yeah.
That's kind of what this book is. That's what this book really is all about.
Let me take a step back to reality that you have dealt with. Your dad, Joe Paterno, famously talked about not getting email or being on email. And, you know, social media was something I think he kind of scoffed at. What would happen when you or other coaches or sports information directors, someone would come to your father and say, here's something that popped up on social media?
Well, he, if it was something that needed to be addressed with the team, he'd address it. He'd say, look, you guys know I'm not on, you know, sometimes he'd say face chat. It wasn't even chat because I don't think Snapchat, but he'd say, you know, I know you guys are on those phones and your computers and saying stuff. He goes, but you've got, you know, you got to realize that other people are reading it. You know, he would give them advice about it and say, look, you got to handle it. You got to handle these things and people are going to criticize you, because sometimes we had players that would get criticized and they'd respond. And that's happened at Penn State the last couple of years as well. And Joe used to always say to us, look, don't get in a pissing contest with a skunk, because you're never going to win. And so that was the advice he always gave us. But I mean, there, you know, we certainly had players do things and say things on social media that we did not want them to do. Sometimes, you know, we had kids, they would repeat lyrics from songs, and the songs were just completely misogynistic or, you know, had a racial component. We'd have to call them in and say, look, I know you like that song, but this is how it reads, and many of your fans don't know that's a song. So, you know, you used to always joke about, you know, when you're a football coach and your phone rings at 2 a.m., you know it's not your academic advisor calling you to tell you that, you know, your player made Dean's List. It's not good.
Okay, the book, I want to make sure that the listeners understand. This is not an X-rated book, but there are some adult themes in the book. A question I have to ask you, Jay, your mom read this book? You let your mom read the book?
Oh, she asked to. She said, look, I want to read it. I want to see what's in there. And she said, oh, my gosh, the language in here. I said, yeah, Mom. I mean, my dad was the exception. He did not cuss on the practice field or anywhere. I mean, he never cussed at all. I mean, I think once or twice I think I heard him say something. But, I mean, generally did not, and did not allow us in the practice field. I said, Mom, that's the exception in college football, I can tell you, because I've been on a lot of practice fields. I coached elsewhere for 5 years, and I've been a practice at a lot of other schools, and I mean, it is the exception. But my mom read it, and she said, "Oh, just." And my mother-in-law, who's going to be 90, she read it, and she was like, "Oh, some of these situations in here. Oh, you know, I like the game part, you know, and that kind of stuff." My mom, the same way, you know, the sidelines. So I mean, it takes you really from not just the recruiting, but also what's it like on a sideline in game day? What gets said in the headsets to each other, and the interaction. So, I mean, it really gives you just pretty much a look at everything you can imagine.
So, Jay, what do you want the takeaway to be other than entertainment?
Well, I think I think what people will get, if you're a college football fan, or even if you're not, you know, there's a lot of drama in here, as you know, and a lot of a really inside look at what the pressures are like inside big-time college football, because you know, we all like to watch the games on Saturdays, but there's so much that goes into it, so much that's behind it, and the pressures that are on coaches and players to perform is massive. And they're going to crack at times. And I think that's, I hope people get a real feel for what it's like to be sitting in those meetings. Because, you know, they do a lot of these reality shows now, but, you know, when a player is accused of a crime, the reality show doesn't go into a coach's meeting and hear what they have to talk about, and doesn't hear what the president says to them, or other groups say, or student affairs conduct people say to them. So, I mean, it takes you into the whole thing.
Jay Paterno is author of Hot Seat, A Year Inside College Football's Pressure Cooker. He's also a Penn State trustee. Jay Paterno, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks. I had a great time. Really enjoyed it.